Chapter 23
"Something ain't right," Big Leo said. "What is it that isn't right about this? Anyone?"
"No oars," Cruxer said. "How the hell did all of us forget oars?"
The Blue Falcon, too, had no oars. It was almost dark, and this was a problem for a Luxin-propelled ship in a river with a current pulling them toward what might be enemies. Standing at the prow of the skimmer, Big Leo said,
"Not that this. That this. That. Something ain't right about that."
He pointed toward the strangers waiting for them with his chin.
"It's my fault," Ben Haydad said, still looking at the Blue Falcon. "My design, my work."
He brightened.
"But, hey, I think I already know how to fix it. Or Hollum's shining smile, boys, it'll be beautiful. Can you fix it now?"
Cruxer asked, looking nervously toward the armed men waiting for them on shore.
"No, no, no, but on Blue Falcon 3, Ben Haydad said. "If we give the oars a convex shape and modify the hull a bit, we can have them fold seamlessly and interlock into the gunnels here. See? They'll nest into each other, and if we make them of bright water, they'll double as armor. Breaker, you think you can do that much solid yellow?"
"Ben,"
Big Leo said, his voice rumbling deep in warning. Ben Haydad clicked his lenses up.
"Hmm?"
"Shut up. Someone tell me what's wrong with this, with them. My gut's going crazy."
"Couldn't be fear," Fakuri offered.
Big Leo leveled a gaze on him like a hammer falling on an errant thumb.
"Not fear," Fakuri amended. "Definitely not fear."
No one else answered Big Leo. The skimmer drifted slowly downstream in the late evening water. No sunlight meant no Luxin. No Luxin meant no motion. No oars meant no options. So they stared at the figures on the riverbank, and the figures stared back at them. They could crack their Lux torches for a source, but those were precious, and they had precious few of them. No one wanted to waste their Lux torches because they were scared of a few villagers.
"The current is pushing us right to them," Tysus said, "and the wind isn't helping."
An improbably large, bare-chested man and a child stood at the shore, but another dozen men and women sat around a cheery fire higher up the bank, cooking dinner and talking quietly.
"We're too interesting for only two of them to be at the shore," Kip said.
"If you do say so yourself," Winston said.
Kip let it go, though he was this close to punching Winston in the nose.
"We're too dangerous-looking," Kip said. "That's what's wrong, Leo."
"They're trying not to spook us," Tysus said, getting it.
"Who tries not to scare six-armed men in uniform?" Kip asked.
"People who are scary themselves, that's who," Fakuri said.
"Quiet, all of you," Cruxer said.
He was holding the waxed leather bag that carried the Mighty's remaining mag torches.
"Winston, I count 14 on the beach. Are there any others in the trees?"
"They're deep foresters," Tysus said. "If there's more hiding in the trees, you'll never see them."
"None in the trees," Winston said, ignoring Tysus.
Cruxer handed out the precious mag torches.
"No one crack one unless I give the order. Or unless I die, I suppose. That is one big, hairy, freckly guy."
There was something feral about the man standing at the water's edge. He wore a brown linen shirt, but it hung fully open, unlaced, to show off a pelt of red chest hair and muscles. The tails of the shirt tucked into his belt, sleeves rolled up short to show bands of polished copper around his enormous biceps. Everywhere he was covered with thick, curly red hair over freckles, chest and arms and stomach. A beard like a burning bush hung halfway down his chest, contrasting with the bald dome of his head, and though Big Leo had a full head's height on him, this warrior was chiseled from stone. Despite the fading light and the distance and hair, Kip could see veins on every muscle, and scars, as if from wild animals. Tysus gasped, and at first Kip was needled that she was appreciating the incredible virility of that wild man, but when he turned to her, she said,
"Look at her!"
The child wasn't a child, but a pygmy. Her appearance rattled something loose, a memory, or... I'm lying face down, motionless, in the jungle underbrush, in the lee of a downed tree. Loathsome things move under my belly and scuttle over my bare hands, most of them harmless, I hope. A bird spider perches on a bough within arm's reach above. Spiders terrify me beyond all measure, but I don't move, don't dare to. Rustling through the underbrush and trees not 20 paces away is the war party. The war blue pygmies carry lances and flails, but the greater danger is the great tiger wolves they ride. Standing tall enough that they look eye to eye with a tall man, they're almost too big for the pygmies to ride. They have long jaws more akin to an alligator's than a dog's, and their riders don't control them so much as direct their viciousness. Tiger wolves aren't trained mounts like a horse, they're more like an arrowhead you strap into. Barely controlled, and that only by will magic. If a rider falls off, he can expect to be eaten first. Sight hunters, so their sense of smell isn't as acute as a dog's, but it is far better than a man's. The key I drafted should have killed the scent of my body. Give it that, the vile stuff. But there's nothing to do about my breath. I don't have it in me to draft key again, not now. I can practically feel the tumors growing every time I do. One of the tiger wolves comes toward me now, big wide paws, silent on the greenery beneath. It growls. My bowels turn to water and I couldn't move if I wanted to. The tiger wolf lunges and snaps its fangs shut on the huge bird spider above me, drool from its slavering jaws splattering across my forehead. Its rider curses and pulls at one of its ears, and it obeys her, chomping happily. Before they turn, I see the rider well, her gaze keen, teeth bared. She is not the same woman. Very alike. Maybe an ancestor. But that woman was not this one. Or perhaps Kip's very unfamiliarity with the pygmies made them all look alike to him. Sharp, elfin features, imperial purple hair, and the permanently upturned mouth and cheek depressions like smiles and dimples that had so often confounded men who repeatedly mistook their expressions and motives, coming to call them smiling devils. For a moment Kip was suspended between the card's knowledge and his own. And then, in the blinking of an eye, he was out of that time that is not time. And then the skimmer scritched onto the pebbles of the riverbank. "Greetings," Kip said. "We've come to fight." That came out wrong. "Not to fight you, obviously," he added. "I mean, we hope not. You wouldn't happen to be fighting for the White King, are you? That would be awkward." "Good old Kip Silvertongue," Winston whispered.
"We know why you've come," the pygmy woman said, her voice high-pitched. "We have been sent to welcome you, Kip Guile, and you, Tisis Guile, born Malagos, and the mighty, we presume."
"That's right," Kip said. "She knew about Tisis and his marriage. How could she know that?"
"I am Shibir Shofra. This is Conrochan Ata. We are of Shady Grove."
"Shady Grove?" Tisis said. "You are far from home indeed." A cloud passed over Shabil's face.
"There is no home now. Not for us. The White King has driven out everyone before him. First we in Shady Grove welcomed refugees, then to our shame and against our traditions we turned aside refugees, then we became refugees in turn. We have lost homes and tribe and spouses and children and land and faith. We have only a thirst for vengeance. Lead us, Leishach, and we will go anywhere, so long as you lead us against that abomination."
"Leishach?" Kip asked, butchering the accent, though terminology probably shouldn't have been foremost on his mind.
"Bringer of light," Tisis said.
"Oh, great, that again." He turned to Shabil and Con Arthur.
"Gather your people."
"They're not ours to command," Con Arthur said. "We here are all clanless, masterless, free."
Kip had never heard anyone say free with such a mix of loathing and despair. Though he'd already had long talks with Tisis about the foresters, apparently he was going to need to have more of them. He waved to people at their fires, almost all of them now looking curiously toward him and the mighty.
"I have things to say. If you want to hear me out, come here," Kip shouted.
More than the 12 people at the fire came. The woods emptied, and over 100 men and women and teens came from the trees. Tisis raised an eyebrow at Winston.
"No people in the woods, huh?"
He cursed under his breath. And as they gathered around Kip, these people, shoeless, hopeless, bereft, eyes glazed with shock and loss, jaws set with pitiless rage, Kip realized he was slipping into the guile role. He would use his words to sway the wills of men. It was the guile talent, more powerful than their magic. Magic requires will, but words shape will, turn it, direct it, reflect it from one target to another. He'd seen it done. He'd marveled at it, envied it, been in awe of his father's profound bedrock conviction that people would do what he wanted them to do. But these lives weren't his to spend, however he willed. He was nothing to these people, a stranger, an interloper. How dare he come to them with promises, much less promises he could never keep. When they were gathered, he said, "I'm Kip Guile. If you've heard of my family, perhaps you know it is their way to sway others to their will, sometimes for good, sometimes not." He shook his head. "I'm not here to be your lord. I'm not here to turn you to my will, to manipulate you or make you my vassals or anyone else's. I'm here to fight. I'm a full-spectrum polychrome, and I've been taught to fight by the best in the world. With others, not alone, I killed King Rascardul of Tyria, and with the Blackguards and Gavin and Carys Guile, I killed Atirat at the Battle of Rhu, just as he was attempting to assume godhood. I know how to fight, and the mighty with me are better than I am, but we don't know this country the way you do. I'm going to hit the Colour Prince, this pretender white king. I'm going to hit him hard, and where he doesn't expect it. I'm going to keep hitting him until one or the other of us dies. I can do a lot of damage with the mighty alone, but alone, I don't think we can stop him. We can do more and better, and live longer if you join us, if we teach each other. If you come with me, we're going to move fast and work hard for long hours and sleep little. We're going to fight and kill and die. That's it. That's all we offer. My goal is to expel the White King from Blood Forest altogether. If we can kill every last damned white while we do it, so much the better. I don't guarantee victory, but I do think victory is possible if we fight together. So no big speech. Join us or don't. Let me know what you've decided in the morning." They looked at him as if they couldn't quite believe that was all he was going to say. But as he got to work setting up tents with the mighty, the crowd slowly dispersed.
"Well, that went," Winston said. "But I guess they aren't trying to kill us, so that's something."
"Shut up, Winston," Tysis said. "Kip, that was perfect."
"I wasn't trying to be perfect. I was trying to be honest."
"That's exactly what they need."
"You said you were sent,"
Kruxa asked Shabeel and Con Arthur, who had remained with them.
"By whom?"
Shabeel smiled, and Kip was certain it was a smile.
"By a prophet you know as the Third Eye, and her husband Corvan Danavis, allies."
"Damn," Big Leo said behind Kip. "You telling me we got a seer on our side? We might have a chance in this war after all."
Shabeel said, "They send their greetings from 1,000 leagues away, and wanted me to tell you this is all the help they can send."
"Well, shit," Big Leo said.